Welcome to New Mexico People, Places, and Ideas. I'm Stephen Spitz. Today we talk about early childhood programs, and the results of certain studies have been truly amazing. Are these programs the silver bullet we've been looking for? Some say no and point to a recent national trial of Head Start programs showing that results had faded by the first grade. Our guest is Dr. Rebecca Kilburn, Director of Child Policy for the RAND Corporation, who is in New Mexico studying seven different early childhood programs throughout the state. Becky Kilburn, welcome to the program.
Thank you.
Becky, I'd like to start with this question. Early childhood programs to me are now like quite the rage, but some of the best and most successful programs that have been studied extensively are very, very old. You know, the Perry's preschool program, the Abecedarian program, the Nurses Family Partnership. These are 20, 30, and 40-year-old programs.
That's right.
So my question really is, what's taken us so long to focus in on early childhood programs when these results from these early programs as long as 40 years ago were pretty spectacular?
Well, I think there's been a confluence of several things in the mid-90s that contributed to this. And one of those was a growing body of brain research that showed that there's an incredible amount of brain development that occurs in the first 3 years of life. And people were able to demonstrate that not only with studies, but with pictures that really capture people's attention. And so the general public, for the first time, became aware of the incredible brain development and learning opportunity in this early period. A second thing was those older programs that you talked about started having long-term results that were truly impressive. So not only did you see outcomes at age 3 or at age 5, but for Perry and others, you started seeing results at age 40, age 25. And that really, again, caught people's imagination.
And then, and they show that people earned more money, spent less time in jail. These are all disadvantaged or at-risk kids, and they've just done better on every sort of behavioral, cognitive, income, economic statistic.
And not only the children, but also their parents demonstrated improved outcomes as well. And I think the last thing that really captured people's attention was a series of cost-benefit studies that tested this idea that if you pay now by providing early childhood programs, that you would save money for government and the public in the long run. And a series of these cost-benefit analyses did demonstrate that you could get a return of anywhere from 4 times higher or even more. So again, in the 90s, there was this convergence of the brain science, these long-term results, these great rates of return. You had people who were not the usual suspects, people like Nobel Prize-winning economists or people like Federal Reserve Bank economists who you wouldn't expect to be the child advocates coming out and saying, look, this is a good investment. This is a good way for the public to spend their money. And it got someone other than the usual suspects talking about early childhood.
Yeah, when you talk about these returns, these are returns on government investments. These are not total returns to society or for the individual child. These are the government's getting 4 times what it puts in benefits.
Yeah, so the idea was that if the government spent, say, $3,000 now or $6,000 now for home visiting or an enriched preschool program, that years later, those same individuals would be less likely to repeat a grade, which costs money, or be in special education, which is more expensive, or get involved in the criminal justice system, go to the emergency room. So years later, the government was saving money on those same individuals that they invested in early childhood.
Now, one study that seemed to really capture people's attention, I think it was in the 90s, was this looking at what's called adverse childhood experiences, the so-called ACE study, which I think is the largest study like this that's ever been conducted, something like 17,000 participants. And the interesting thing about that study, it wasn't at risk or disadvantaged people. It was people of all socioeconomic classes. And what the study seemed to show was that if you had a certain number of adverse childhood experiences, those adverse childhood experiences would better explain how you performed later in adult life better than anything else, better than your SAT score, better than your educational achievement, better than anything. And that study seemed to really capture people.
Yeah, the original ACES study looked at health outcomes of adults and was among a Kaiser Permanente population in San Diego. And they asked adults if they had experienced a number of factors before the age of 18. So these were things like, did you have a parent who was incarcerated? Did you have a family member who had a substance abuse problem? So these seven factors were predictive of not only behavioral health outcomes for these adults, but also physical health outcomes. People were really shocked. It predicted things like blood pressure, rates of cancer. So it was...
That's really kind of mind-boggling.
It was very striking to people. And since then, the same type of analysis has looked not only at health outcomes, but also labor market outcomes, whether you attend college, whether you complete college, things like marital dissolution.
All by these adverse childhood experiences.
That's right.
So we have this ACES study, and it shows that if there are these adverse childhood experiences, there can be adverse effects later in life, behavioral, physical, etc. But what does that say about what we should do with early childhood programs? Because now all you've done is shown that if you have these bad experiences, there'll be an adverse effect.
I think it's led to an increasing emphasis on either preventing children from being exposed to these experiences or promoting family resiliency. And what that means is the child's ability to not have negative outcomes if they're exposed to some of these experiences. So what that means in terms of a program is you might, in a home visiting program, for example, try to identify families where there's a member who has a substance abuse issue and make sure that gets treated so that the child, it lowers the chance that the child is in a substance abusing household for a long time and experiences negative consequences as a result. So a secondary approach in the early childhood programs is to develop skills for the family and the child that allow them to sort of weather these adverse childhood experiences, better coping skills, better conflict resolution skills, better interpersonal skills, so that if they are exposed to, say, a family member going to jail, that they're better able to navigate that situation and don't have as many negative outcomes. So home visiting is sort of particularly well-suited to addressing adverse childhood experiences in a way that maybe preschool doesn't have the same tools available.
If you've just tuned in, this is New Mexico People, Places, and Ideas. My name is Stephen Spitz, and I'm very pleased to be speaking with Dr. Rebecca Kilburn today. She is an economist, and she's the director of child policy for the RAND Corporation. And I'd like to turn, Becky, to the program you're evaluating in Santa Fe and just maybe just generally talk to tell people about. As I understand it, you have normed the program in Santa Fe to six other programs throughout the state in different cities like Silver City, Socorro, Albuquerque, Los Alamos, I think. There's others. And what exactly is this program and what are you really doing in your evaluation?
Well, along with some RAND colleagues, I'm evaluating the Firstborn program, which is a home visiting program for new parents. And RAND was interested in evaluating the Firstborn program because it was a home visiting program that took a health promotion and prevention approach to improving children's outcomes, but did not require nurses like the leading home visiting model. If you look at the evidence-based home visiting models around the country, the Nurse Family Partnership is one of the most well-known programs, but because New Mexico doesn't have an extensive nursing workforce, that type of program wouldn't be feasible in New Mexico. So what the Firstborn program does is it combines a registered nurse with other trained home visitors in order to use a workforce that's available in many more places in order to deliver the same type of curriculum in order to help parents learn better parenting skills, improve their knowledge on everything from car seats to nutrition to how to treat sick kids, and also do things like screen for postpartum depression, identify kids who might need additional screening for developmental delays. So this program has a lot of the features of the Nurse Family Partnership, but does it with a workforce that New Mexico has and a lot of other places.
So when you say evidence-based program, what you mean is a randomized study that shows that kids who participate in this program are better off than kids who don't?
That's right. And our study in Santa Fe uses a randomized trial design so that we can meet the federal standards for being evidence-based and qualify for federal funding. But as part of that, we wanted to confirm that the Santa Fe home visiting program is representative of all the other firstborn programs. So we sort of benchmarked the Santa Fe site against the original site in Silver City and the other six sites in the state.
And what are the other six sites?
Los Alamos County, Rio Riba County, there's a Socorro site. There's now a large and growing site in South Albuquerque. There was a site in Taos that's no longer a firstborn site, and then Silver City and Santa Fe.
And so I guess one question I have, and I asked this to Alan Sanchez, because I had an earlier program where we discussed the Albuquerque program, which is headed by Alan. Why isn't there an educational component to this program? Is it just because the kids are too young? I mean, it's 0 to 3, so at some point it would seem to me to make some sense to introduce some, you know, learning to the children as well as the health benefits.
Well, a big part of the curriculum actually is an educational component. So these are usually weekly home visits. In the first year, the home visitor meets with the family about 40 times. And one of the topics that's covered is child development and, you know, what's happening now, what can your child be learning now, what's reasonable to expect. And they review some learning activities that the parents can undertake with the kids that are aligned with the child's development at that particular stage.
Yeah, there are all these studies that show that if you read to your children like 3 times a week, or if you talk to your children more, or if you just use more words with your children, that child will be better prepared for the first grade, better prepared for kindergarten, better prepared throughout that child's life, right? There's just simply no question about this anymore, based on the evidence, right?
Right.
So I want to ask you about the Head Start program that I mentioned at the start of the show, the top of the show, and the headline is Head Start doesn't work, and we've basically wasted $170 billion on Head Start, and what this recent randomized national trial shows is that by the first grade, the child participants are performing no better than participants who didn't participate in the Head Start program. So does that show that Head Start doesn't work?
The unfortunate thing is the news isn't quite that grim, but it's not a lot better. And what I mean by that is that there have been literally hundreds of studies of Head Start, since the 60s.
It started in 65 or something like
that. That's right. And so people I guess about 5 or 6 years ago, thought we ought to know something after decades of Head Start research. And it turns out we really didn't. And the reason is they didn't use these evidence-based research designs like a randomized trial and had some design weaknesses. And so we weren't really sure if Head Start was making a difference, or if it was the fact that more motivated parents were enrolling their kids in Head Start, or a better neighborhood was more likely to have a Head Start program. So Congress and other people said, you know, we need a randomized trial on this. So about 5 years ago, the randomized trial started that you referenced. And so people said, this is great. You know, we're going to finally know if Head Start works. We're going to have a rigorous research design, and this is great. And so we got the results back, and the answer is we still don't know. And the reason is because now when you have children randomly assigned to Head Start, the children who are randomly assigned to something else are often tending to get another form of high-quality, often publicly provided preschool.
If you just tuned in, this is New Mexico People, Places, and Ideas. My name is Stephen Spitz, and we're really pleased to have on the program today Dr. Rebecca Kilborn, who's an economist, and she's here studying early childhood programs in New Mexico. And Becky, I'd like to ask you some questions that really about a book I read that really caught my attention, called Whatever It Takes. It's written by Paul Tough, and it's about Jeff Canada's program, Harlem Children's Zone program in Canada. I'd like to ask you, start with his failure. And that his failure was really was he starts out all kinds of different aspects, but he starts a sixth-grade program. And the sixth graders turn to seventh graders, turn to eighth graders. He's able to do everything that people say they want to do in education. You know, longer school days, longer school years. He's able to hire whatever teachers he wants. He's got all the money he needs to hire the best teachers. He's able to fire the teachers he wants to fire. The turnover is incredible. If they don't perform, they're out. He's able to motivate in every way he wants to motivate. And then it turns out that the kids at the end of the eighth grade, these are disadvantaged, at-risk kids, those are the ones he's interested in, aren't performing any better than kids generally, disadvantaged kids generally in the New York public school systems. And one of the things this seems to say to me is that we're being kind of rough on teachers. You know, that if if this program with all this emphasis and all this intensity, and they drilled and killed and they did everything they could to bring up scores and it didn't work, it seems like, you know, it's not the unions that are stopping us. It's not the teachers that are stopping us. It's not the cognitive skills maybe that are stopping us. It's the non-cognitive aspects of these students that are stopping us. And I don't know what teachers can do about that.
Well, I think that early experience that the Harlem Children's Zone had demonstrates a couple of things. And one is that we've known for a long time from research and just everyone's experience that children's outcomes in school is really a partnership between the schools and the family. And in decades of studies where people were trying to understand what improves kids' test scores, when you control for family factors, that is always the largest part of the explanation. And so, can schools improve kids' outcomes? Absolutely, we know that they can. But it's also the case that in order to really make a difference in children's outcomes, you have to in some way involve the family. And so what that book describes that Canada does next is say, okay, how can we involve the family in this, and how can we view this as a partnership rather than just something that the school is going to do by itself?
So I guess some people might conclude, and I've heard a number of people say this, that you kind of give up on sixth graders. You know, by the time kids get to the sixth grade, it's kind of a wasted effort. We ought to really concentrate all our efforts on zero early childhood to through the fifth grade. And, you know, when you're talking about late, you know, in adolescence, there's not all that much you can do. Would you subscribe to that?
Well, I would say that psychologists, economists, and other people are increasingly characterizing outcomes in adolescence and after adolescence as the result of a developmental process that starts in early childhood and continues on through adolescence. And so it wouldn't be the case that just a high-quality early childhood program would be enough to, say, inoculate a child for the rest of his or her life for good outcomes and they live happily ever after, but rather once you establish the strong foundation in early childhood and get them off to a good start, you would need to continue to invest in children and nurture them along the way. And similarly, you wouldn't be able to just go in and try to, quote, rescue someone in adolescence who hadn't had a good early childhood foundation. And so it's really the case that you would want to make sure that the child is getting, as an economist would say, developmental inputs all along the way from early childhood through adolescence. And really, if you miss key inputs and key developmental windows anywhere along that way, you might find compromised outcomes.
Yeah, and Canada has this concept he talks about as the conveyor belt. He starts out with the baby college, and that feeds into an early childhood program, which feeds into a pre-K program, which feeds into a kindergarten program. It's just exactly what you're talking about. He talks about enough velocity to escape sort of the disadvantages that these kids have.
And that's a really good representation of, if you look at, say, Jim Heckman, an economist, his developmental model in economics called the human capital model, where you have these repeated periods where you have inputs in every period, and the output from that period is the input to the next period. And also psychologists have a model of development, and Canada's conveyor belt is a really good way to describe, I think, really what underlies all of those different models.
But one of the things you told me about before the show began off the air was a RAND study, I think, with eighth graders in L.A., where these at-risk kids were performing very poorly. And then why don't you take it from there?
Yeah. What you're talking about is known as the CBITS study, C-B-I-T-S. And some of my colleagues at RAND interviewed middle school students in some of the toughest neighborhoods in Los Angeles and found that over half of the students exhibited clinical levels of post-traumatic stress disorder, or PTSD. And we normally associate that with, returning war veterans and other people who've been exposed to trauma. And what they developed was a cognitive behavioral intervention that could be delivered at school and helped kids reduce symptoms of anxiety and fear. And they not only had better behavioral health outcomes, but they also missed less school. They had better grades. They used a randomized trial design and published the results in the top medical journal. But what it did show was that you can do an intervention when kids are in middle school or high school and improve certain outcomes.
But the thing is, it's not drill and kill. It's completely different than that. The intervention is not at all what we think of as improving kids' performance, right?
Yeah, it's related to another issue that's gaining prominence in this scientific literature on child development and this life course idea, and that is that some of the most important aspects of the interventions are developing what some people are calling non-cognitive skills as well as cognitive skills. And that's true for both the children and the parents. And what they mean by that is that you not only need to know your letters and your numbers and things like that when you're entering school, but you also need to know certain skills like self-control when you're entering first grade, or you need to know that you listen when the teacher is talking. And, you know, those are very easy examples. But as you get older, it begins to include things like making good choices, reducing your risky behavior, sticking to it, things like, staying in there and graduating from high school. And so some of the long-term outcomes that are now showing to have the biggest impact in adulthood are related to the ability of some of these interventions to improve young people's non-cognitive skills rather than just that their academic performance is improving or they're getting better test scores.
Yeah, I want to ask you just about one more thing about this part of it, and that is this contamination idea. This is something that Jeff Canada talks about and that Alan Sanchez talked about. And the idea is that the model for these disadvantaged areas will change. And now there'll be a different role model. And Canada talks about it being at least 60%. Alan didn't really identify it. And I really want to ask you, is there any science behind this contamination idea? Can we really change the disadvantaged area by going in and having a home visiting program and a preschool program, and all of a sudden the model changes for how people will perform?
Well, I don't know of any evidence that shows that a disadvantaged area through contamination can have a corner turn, say. But there is some suggestive research evidence that shows things like the following. Like if your child is in kindergarten or first grade with peers who were in high-quality preschool, that there's a contamination effect from being in this classroom with all of these kids who were in a high-quality preschool. And so that's an example of this type of contamination.
Yeah, it certainly is.
Easy to, you know, pretty easy to measure and quantify and understand, and it's been demonstrated to have a real effect.
Okay, so we're nearing the end of the show, and I want to ask one final thing. Okay, so if you were Philosopher King and you had access to all the money that's spent on 0 to 5 year old programs, what would you do? How would you take that money and use it in the best way that you know how to use it?
Well, economists call that the benevolent despot. And if I was the benevolent despot, I would, instead of choosing the one program that's the silver bullet like you described, I would instead invest in a portfolio of programs. And the reason for that is that you see different families having different needs and at different stages, even of the 0 to 5 cycle. So what I would try to do is provide some infant services and some services closer to preschool. And what you would ideally do is identify families who have different risk factors and focus on different risk factors and different factors that occur at different ages. So, for example, if you were able to screen children early on, which New Mexico does a very good job at, one of the areas where New Mexico excels is it has one of the highest rates of early developmental screening in the country. And that allows you to do something like identify kids who would benefit from, say, occupational therapy or physical therapy during that particular developmental window where you have an opportunity to really make a difference. And so what I would do is, again, instead of saying, well, I'll run a horse race between home visiting and preschool and pick one, but rather have a sort of portfolio that's tailored to families who have different needs at different developmental stages.
Well, we're going to have to leave it there. I'd like to thank my guest so much, Dr. Rebecca Kilburn, who's Director of Child Policy for the RAND Corporation. Thanks also to my engineer, Joe Green. You've been listening to New Mexico People, Places, and Ideas. My name is Stephen Spitz. Local podcasts of this show are available at KUNM.org. Archives of my prior shows are available at the Spitz Report. Thanks for listening. See you next time.